From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. Let's get right to it. Our first clip this week comes from a woman who is remarkably brave in telling her story. Her name is Caitlin. She grew up in the Buffalo area. And at the age of 19, she was an alcoholic. A human trafficker named Kenneth White picked her up and took her to New York City, where he sold her into prostitution for 8 years. He physically abused her and forced her to stay.
But eventually, White was arrested, and Caitlin now tells her story to help other victims. You might be wondering how he was able to control her. Here she is in this clip explaining.
It's important to stick to the facts, because if you don't stick to the absolute direct and narrow facts, people aren't going to really understand. But what Kenneth White did was make this seem so normal. Because I was discussing it with Adam before, it literally is like a subculture of people. And there's so many girls that I've seen come and go throughout the years. That was the only thing with Kenneth White. He never let me go. I don't know why. I don't know if it was because I was the first. And I did try and leave several times. But he would let other girls come and go. If they didn't want to be there, he would say, fine. He would get them a bus ticket, send them home. But for some reason, he never ever tried to let me go.
Did you tell him you wanted to go?
Yeah. I would cry to him. I want to go home. I want to go home. And he would, he knew how to play the game. He knew that when I was feeling weak, he would use sex. He would use expensive gifts, things like that, to make it seem like it's worth it for staying. And I would say, I want to go. I want to go. But I really had nowhere to go. A pimp and prostitute relationship, and if you want to call it a relationship, if that, it very closely mirrors a domestic violence relationship where they come in, they isolate you. They, you know, you have no resources for anything whatsoever. They restrict any money you may have or be holding. And I tried to stash money before, and I don't know how he always found it. He must have checked everything whenever I wasn't in the room. He was able to find money. I hid in the bottom of sneakers. And it was always like, I'm going to save just enough to get away. And then there were times where I did get away. I went to a domestic violence shelter and he somehow found me. I would come out to go to an appointment for Section 8 to try and get an apartment on my own. And he would be parked on the street and physically bring me back into the car.
What were those moments like?
Terrifying. Absolutely terrifying. He used physical force and intimidation on a regular basis. I documented everything though. I went to the hospital and they knew who I was. They knew what I was doing and they were frankly getting sick of seeing me. I've been in hospitals all over the country because he assaulted me hundreds of times and put me in the hospital over 20 times for all those assaults.
Did you think he was going to kill you?
Yeah, there was times I did. I have a scar right here on my hand from when he held a knife to my throat, and not thinking about anything, I grabbed the knife with my hand and pulled it away from my throat, and I actually had to go to the hospital and get stitches for that blade mark across my hand.
Most of the time, when he was physically violent, did he hit you? Did he do other things?
Punched, kicked, stomped. I would go to the hospital. I would have Timberland boot prints all over me, and they could see clearly I had been trampled because you could see the imprint of the boot prints.
Did he, when you had finally sort of recovered as best you could from those, did he then say, look, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to get angry? Did he try to smooth talk you into staying, or was it more intimidation?
He never said he was sorry, ever. He would turn it around, gaslight the girls, and make you believe that it was your fault that you got hit. If I hadn't have done this, I wouldn't have gotten that. And he really was good at drilling that mentality into you.
But did you believe it?
At the time, I did. I would blame myself for being there. I would say, this is my fault. You know, I knew better. And it really is almost like a form of mental illness.
Next up, astrophysicist Adam Frank has had it with people who don't trust the experts. Frank wrote a piece for NPR defending the value of real expertise. He says our polarized political culture has made experts a target for derision.
In particular, Frank says this has caused damage in the fight against climate change. Let's listen.
You go to the doctor and the doctor says, you know, listen, you got something in your brain that we need to operate on. You're not going to say, hey, well, you know, the guy next to me says he'll do it for $9.95. And I think he knows something about it. You know, he knows how to spell brain. So I'm going to go ask him to do it. I mean, there's just the great problem with this is there's a difference between the way people talk and then the way they behave. If you need to build a factory and you need to put in, you know, a large air conditioning and heating system, you're not going to, you know, go to the guy next door door who knows nothing about venting. You have to figure out, you know, how large the vents have to be and put in. And so, you know, people will actually seek out experts in whatever field it is when they need something done. And yet in this weird political environment, we're blowing off expertise as if, you know, it's not important.
I appreciate the way in your piece you distill it this way. You essentially say, imagine going into someone's workplace and where they've been for years and telling them, I wouldn't do it this way, even though you've never been trained on what they do, whether right. they're a car mechanic or someone who works in an office or someone who works as a project manager. No, I don't think you should do it this way because I have an opinion. And they would probably rightly be offended to say, well, who are you to come into my workplace and tell me exactly how this works?
Exactly. That's the part that is amazing. And I've tried this sometimes. You know, I was at a dinner one time, and I'm like a climate evangelist where I'm bringing it up. I'm going to bring it up. I'm going to mention, we're going to talk about something, and there's an opportunity. I'm going to bring up climate because, you know, this is not something that should be polarized, right? There's the question of—
And it shouldn't be politicized.
Right, exactly. Because, you know, the issue of whether the climate is changing, why it's changing, and the range of possibilities because of its change, that's purely an issue of science. What you do about it, okay, that's politics and values, and, you know, we can talk about different opinions about that. But, you know, I went to a dinner, and I, you know, sort of was raising the issue of climate, and one guy said, oh, you believe the climate's changing. And, you know, so I just sort of probed a little bit. And then, you know, he started, you know, he gave me this. So there's this line you often hear from climate denialists that is the dumbest true thing ever, which is to say, well, you know, the climate's always changing.
I do love that.
You know, and it's like, okay, you just said that.
That just like shuts down the argument.
Right, yeah. Right. So then it's like, okay, you know, you just said that. Now let's probe a little bit deeper because you made a statement, right? And so then what it becomes clear often is that there's no knowledge underneath that. There's no understanding. You know, there's no reading that's been done about, because here's the real question about that. When people say, you know, the climate's changing all the time, well, yes, on 10,000-year or 100,000-year timescales, the climate has actually been incredibly stable for the entire 10,000 years of human civilization. And so the thing that's just amazing is that people will make these statements where not only do they not have they not done the work, you know, but then they're not even interested in the fact that somebody else has. So that's what I think about humility. We all need to be humble before the things we don't understand. I understand very little about most things, right? Genetics, for example. You'd never have me on the show to come and talk about genetic medicine, right? So that's something I don't know. I have to listen to people and let the people who've done the work tell me about it. And yet with climate, which is this huge issue for the future of humanity, people make these incredible statements, and I'm sorry to say this, but will parade their ignorance as if it's a virtue. And that's something that has changed recently, that all of us in all the fields have to really, you know, look deep in our hearts about what we're doing.
Next, we turn our attention to the lack of diversity in classical music. It's still a very white field. There are very few Black and Latino performers and very few Black and Latino audience members. The Eastman School of Music is trying to change that with various efforts.
We met an African-American double bassist, second-year student Delaney Harris. She's from Los Angeles, and she shared her perspective as one of the few classical music students of color.
One of the things about lack of diversity that I really realized after coming to Eastman was what we were just talking about, the pipeline and opportunity and things. Because Eastman is obviously just such a great school. And looking back to where I'm from, the neighborhood that I live in is some 97-98% Black. And to think that the people in my neighborhood and where I'm from literally have no idea places like Eastman exist. And I find that baffling because this is such a great opportunity. And that's one of the huge issues. The diversity comes from people not even knowing that this is an option for them. It's actually beyond their scope of the world. And that's what's really just, it's crazy to me because I love Eastman so much and I'm really glad that I'm able to attend Eastman, and I want that for other people. But if people end up not going to places like this, I want it to be because they decided that that's not for them, not because they never had a shot.
You know? I think that's beautifully said. What about your friends, those you grew up with, who sort of watch you, you know, go down this path, picking up these fascinating instruments? I mean, what were they saying?
Well, actually, my best friend is a tuba player.
All right.
yeah, and so
great
we,
duets.
So we talk about classical music a lot, and she ended up not going into music. But so I do have some friends that, you know, play classical music, and I also went to an arts high school. But some of the people that I grew up with in my neighborhood are just like, they're totally, like, it just goes right over their head. They're like, I don't know what that is or what you're doing or why you like it because we don't understand it. And I don't know.
And Delaney, Lee mentioned, and I think, and Paul talked about just this great opportunity coming up in August with Gateways to have these audiences seeing models on stage, people who look like them. You know, when we talk about lack of diversity in teaching, we talk about how especially African-American students in the Rochester region, city and suburbs and rural areas, rarely see teachers who look like them. Students tell us, you know, who's going to inspire me? Not that teachers of different racial backgrounds can't inspire, but we know, the research tells us, that when you don't have models who look like you, you're less likely to feel like you've got an inspiring role model. How were you able to, I mean, did you grapple with that at all as you learned to play music? Did you say, hey, where are the African-American composers? How come they're not getting the same kind of love? Or what's the story here?
Well, I did a lot of different programs when I was in middle school and high school, and two of the programs that I was in were actually catered to minority students. So I actually did, there were some of the initiatives that were being taken, like the LA Phil has the Youth Orchestra Los Angeles, which is primarily Latino students. That's where I started playing bass and throughout the program. And also the Inner City Youth Orchestra of Los Angeles, which is almost all Black, an orchestra that I love being involved with and really is doing great work to diversify this field. But when I would go places outside of those places, yeah, I would be, you know, the only Black person, the only person of color there. And sometimes it can be discouraging, but I think about the greater good in that if I don't do it, then the people behind me, you know, the people who are younger than me, I can be that role model for them. So I think that it's very important that I, you know, keep at it.
Let's close with the comments made by two newly minted teachers, James Flagler and Danielle Maxwell, our recent college graduates in our area, Fisher and College of Brockport. Both were able to find teaching jobs right out of school. Now, Danielle took a job in Arizona. James is going to be teaching in the Rochester City School District. And in this clip, he explains why he kind of surprised himself by deciding he would take a job in Rochester instead of taking a job that was available to him back in his home school district in central New York.
It is a very undervalued profession, I would say, and probably less so in New York State than other places, but nationally, education is undervalued. And that's something going into it, you know, financially it's an undervalued profession. But the ways you get paid are incredible. There's no price tag you can really put on them. A lot of the work I do, I just sit down in the cafeteria during the lunch periods, and I'll be working on whatever, and there'll be a kid sitting by themselves, and I'll go over. We have a few kids that are refugee immigrants from the Middle East and recent arrivals, don't have the English skills. I downloaded an Arabic translator on my phone. So a kid that would usually be sitting in lunch by themselves, not having that social interaction with their peers, and I'm talking fourth graders, eighth graders, young kids that crave that social interaction, to be able to, hey, he's my friend. Mr. Flagler will stop by and he'll sit down and talk with me during lunch, even if it's over his phone. It's cool to see a kid that just has a frown on their face all day because they can't communicate with anyone. And to see them light up when you type on your phone, how are you doing today? And it pops up in Arabic and they're able to read it. And then you're able to teach them some English, and I've learned some Arabic from them. It's been cool. That's another thing. It's so rewarding. It doesn't matter the pay.
And have you had anyone in your life, family, friends, peers in teaching programs, peers who are not in teaching programs, say to you, James, are you really sure you want to work in the city school district? You know, they have different challenges. Obviously, there's more poverty. Have you encountered anybody pushing back on this?
I would say peers more so than family. I have a brother that teaches in the city school district at East High. I have a sister-in-law that taught in the city school district for 7 years and now is an administrator in Greece. And they understand the challenges, but the rewards that come with working in the city school district. But there has been peers, like, you tell them that you got a job teaching in the inner city in Rochester, and they look at you like, what are you doing? And I tell people like that, how often have you interacted with kids in the city? How often have you been able to experience some of the experiences that I've been able to experience? How many of those type of kids do you know? Because I have found in my interaction with those kids is that they are some of the most tremendously strong and talented kids that I have ever met. We just had a talent show today at School 45. This is like my extended lunch. The principal let me
on. Do they know you're here?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, good.
And we had a talent show. We had a kid playing the drums to Bruno Mars. And a Bruno might need an extra drummer. This kid is in sixth grade, and he played one of Bruno Mars' songs on the drums to a T. Had another kid dancing to Michael Jackson. Just some of the talents that are in kids, and they're not always like very publicized, because so often you hear, well, they're not doing well on their English proficiency exams or their math exams, and you hear all that and you forget that they're kids that have talents and have passions, and they're very driven, and it's cool when you're able to facilitate them being able to get to that, because in the city school district they do encounter a lot more challenges and trauma than, say, a kid in suburban areas do. And what I say to that is a lot of kids put up a front because they have to put up a front. Imagine walking down the street at 9 o'clock at night in the city. You have to put up a front if you want to get home sometimes. But when you break that front and when a kid takes it down, that is just an incredible experience because you realize they're kids. They're kids that are craving attention. They're craving attention from their parents. They're craving acceptance from their peers, just like every other kid. But sometimes it takes more time and patience to break that front because they have to put it on every day.
And so when you talk to your peers who occasionally say, you know, you sure you want to work in the city? And I think you're right. I don't think this is an indictment of your friends. This is just a reflection on society. A lot of people who grow up with pretty good means don't interact with people in different circumstances.
Yeah.
And they have assumptions. Sometimes those assumptions are drawn from, you know, commercial news. Sometimes they're drawn from fictionalized shows or whatever it is that they've got their assumptions from. But they might not have that experience. So when you at least tell them, look, I think what you're assuming is off here, and you start telling your experiences, does that soften them a little? Are they keen on hearing more?
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's good.
It's cool because it's often, I think, sometimes prejudice and stereotyping just comes from a lack of experience. But you got to be openness. You have to have some openness to that experience.
And that does it for another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS, that's Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM.
We're also on the WXXI mobile app. Have a great weekend, everyone. We'll talk to you Monday.